Chapter 39, Disillusionment and New Directions. In 1972, when I became active in the Klan again, it was a fading remnant of past glory. However, the intelligent leaders of the group, such as Don Black, my second-in-command, James MacArthur, our newspaper editor, and our other leaders across America, had breathed life into it. The Klan then became increasingly attractive to the more educated and successful of our heritage. We preached legality and nonviolence and sought to educate and organize European Americans for the preservation of our race, cultural heritage, and freedom. Attracted by the radical image of the Klan name and its mystery, the media found the Klan irresistible. They simply had to cover it, even if just to denigrate it. When I had the opportunity to speak, I always sought to tell the racial truth in an intelligent and reasonable way. In part, the interest of the Klan came from the media's sensationalistic coverage, and that in turn made the group fascinating to the public. Many Klansmen in the 1960s alleged that agents of the federal government actually encouraged illegality, and then, once they initiated violence, used the illegality to destroy the organizations. COINTELPRO, the government's counterintelligence program, orchestrated a series of dirty tricks against Klansmen, even to the extent of sending a phony love letter to a Klan leader's wife suggesting infidelity, thus hoping to destroy their marriage and weaken the movement. All this was reported, by the way, in the United States Congress. They also had Klan leaders harassed by the IRS or arrested on trumped-up charges, or had FBI agents visit them on their jobs, causing some of them to be fired. In a very anti-David Duke book called The Rise of David Duke, a police officer is quoted as saying that even though they knew it was not true, their agents would tell Klansmen that I was an FBI informant. They would go at any lengths to discredit and weaken my organization. Quote, the undercover agents were under orders to try to undermine Duke's credibility by responding that Duke was actually a police informer. Quote, we'd say, hey, he's with us, unquote. It wasn't true, but we hoped word would get out so he'd have less credibility among his own supporters, said Fred O'Sullivan, who headed the New Orleans Police Intelligence Unit when Duke got his start in the Klan. Ultimately, they promoted a more radical and pro-violent competing Klan group to weaken my organization and to hurt the Klan image. A member of my organization, Bill Wilkinson, broke off from my group under the auspices of the FBI. Later discovery of FBI records by the Nashville Tennessean showed that he had regularly conferred with them only days after joining my Klan. The interesting thing was that Wilkinson's group used inflammatory, hateful rhetoric and became involved in violence against minorities. He used the derogatory term nigger, which I did not, and cultivated a Hollywood-style version of the Klan as a violent and hate-motivated organization. When asked about the prominent display of weapons at his rallies, he'd tell reporters, shotguns are for killing people. Even though I couldn't prevent distortions by the press, I was always careful to present a good image of the Klan when I spoke to the press. Wilkinson understood that the media loved to give big publicity to anyone spouting hateful and violent rhetoric. Because there was no copyright on the KKK name, we could not keep him from presenting himself as a legitimate Klan leader. The public had difficulty understanding that the Klan groups were not all alike. As the Klan I led grew dramatically, I did not realize at first that the excellent publicity I had cultivated would help not just my own organization, but all the Klan groups, some of whom more reflected the Hollywood image than its historical reality. More of these so-called Klan leaders began to appear on TV talk shows, sometimes representing just a handful of people, yet presented as, quote, the Klan. One, quote, Klansman of this stripe did more damage to my work than a dozen anti-Klan programs or dramatic stories. It was one thing for the media to allege that the Klan was hateful and stupid. It was altogether worse for a, quote, Klansman to behave that way. Of course, this was a result of the unassailed power of the media, for obviously they could televise ignorant and hateful members of any group. This problem has continued on into the late 1990s and early 21st century, illustrated by a Klan leader from Louisiana featured a few times on the Jerry Springer Show, who was, in fact, living with a black woman. The government and the Jewish groups took a role in promoting such false Klan leaders and encouraging conflicts between organizations. Those efforts hurt my carefully cultivated media approach and ultimately my credibility. When I went on a TV or radio show, I always pointed out that the Klan was a legal, law-abiding movement for the preservation of our European American heritage, and that it was not about hatred of other races, but simply the love of our own families and our own people. All it took was for the host to play a tape of another, quote, Klan leader who talked about killing the Negroes and the Jews to make me look untruthful. Hosts also loved to throw up a violent act committed by a Klansman, even though I never had the slightest connection to the perpetrator or the organization he belonged to. A whole cadre of idiots came out of the woodwork who discovered they could get a lot of publicity, maybe even an all-expense-paid trip to Los Angeles or New York City by putting on a Klan costume and saying outlandish things. The media loved it. Since the Klan had no copyright, it was impossible to curtail such activities. It is not possible to expel people that do not even belong to your own group in the first place. It was a difficult period. The authorities informed us of serious assassination threats against me. I traveled most of the time, leaving little time for the needs of my family. We had little money, and I continued struggling with the jealousies and rivalries between different Klan movements. By the late 1970s, I was frustrated by constantly having to deal with alleged statements of counterfeit Klans and having the allegations against other Klans thrown in my face. It became harder to discuss the critical issues facing our race and nation. Every aspect of my life seemed difficult and strained, including my marriage. I was certainly not the easiest person to live with at that time. Ultimately, Chloe and I separated, and she returned to South Florida to live near her parents, although she was still as committed to the cause as I was. We stayed respectful of each other and faithfully committed to the well-being of our children. I remained in Louisiana and was at a turning point in my life. I was proud of the historical Klan and what we had accomplished in the 1970s, but it seemed we weren't moving toward the victory that motivated me. I knew that the most important thing wasn't any particular organization, but the victory we had to win to preserve and advance our heritage. Although I still revered the honorable history and tradition of the original organization of Reconstruction and the good work of the Klan that I led, it became obvious to me that the movement had to take a new form if it were to succeed. The Klan is not an end in itself. It has meaning solely as an instrument for the survival and evolutionary advancement of our people. I believe no matter how much I love the symbols and heritage of the organization, that I had to take whatever path I believed to be the most effective for the sacred cause of our racial survival and upward evolution. The external veneer of a movement is not vital. Its underlying principles and substance are what's truly sacred. I also felt that those who fulfilled the Hollywood image of the Klan, whether intentionally or not, did the memory of the once noble organization a great wrong. But I did not want to say anything critical of those who sincerely were doing the best they knew how for their heritage. I called a meeting of the important leaders of the organization, and we discussed a possible name change for the organization, one that would differentiate our group from the others and enable us to register it and protect its reputation. We desired a name that could express our principles without any association to illegality, violence, or racial hatred. We decided to start a new organization and let those who still wanted to take the Klan approach remain with the Klan group. My close friend and second command, Don Black, succeeded me as Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan, and I decided to develop an altogether new organization. Over the years, many people had suggested to me the name National Association for the Advancement of White People. If there could be a National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, why couldn't there be a group dedicated to the rights and heritage of whites? The concept grew on me, and I saw that simply using the name would expose the double standards of the media. Every one of our top leaders, Don Black, Jay MacArthur, and others, agreed with my plan to form the National Association for the Advancement of White People. Even those who said they would remain with the Knights of the Ku Klux Klan understood my sentiments and endorsed my efforts with the NAAWP. The NAAWP had a strong start. I was able to recruit two retired U.S. Navy admirals for our national board, Admiral John G. Cromlin, who was referred to as the heart of the USS Enterprise aircraft carrier during the Second World War, and Admiral Ira McMillan, retired. I had also obtained endorsement for the group from a courageous retired Marine officer, General Pedro Del Valle, who lived near Annapolis, Maryland. From the beginning, the NAAWP approach was effective. Although it did not receive the same level of publicity that the Klan did, it was much better publicity. No allegation of illegality or violence could be cast against it. All of our spokesmen represented our views accurately, and only our designated leaders had our permission to officially speak for the organization. More and more people began to understand that I did not advocate violence or oppression, but represented a legal organization trying to stop the discrimination and oppression of whites and their heritage. Although a good tool to use in comparison with the NAACP, we later sought our own solid name and created the European American Unity and Rights Organization, EURO, which I still lead today. The next chapter is Chapter 40, Political Victory.